Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Historic flooding in northeastern Iowa has killed at least one person, washed out numerous roads, and damaged hundreds of homes.
1,000 miles southeast of Miami, there is another system that we're looking at. Forecasters say it could be a risk to South Florida this weekend. The last hurricane to strike Florida was in 2005.
Yes, welcome to yet another Wild Weather Week. Record floods in Iowa, tornadoes in Indiana, and Florida on edge for a weekend tropical storm. Extreme weather, lions, tigers, and bears. Oh, my. I'm NPR News Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. Let's go to the Weather Lab.
The National Weather Service in Duluth, Minnesota has issued a tornado warning for...
Oh, my God, it's a tornado!
A confirmed large and extremely dangerous tornado was located 4 miles...
Look at what it did to the house across the way. All these houses are just torn up.
In chaos theory, the butterfly effect is the sensitive dependence on initial conditions.
Does the flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil set off a tornado in Texas?
Extreme weather events have increased in frequency over the last 50 years or so, and they're expected to become even more common, more intense, and more costly.
We're either going to price your insurance at a huge markup, or we're not going to write it at all.
Happy Friday, everybody. You know, if this summer seems like an extreme weather triathlon, you're not alone. I've tracked multiple severe storm waves blowing down trees across Minnesota this summer. I watched the Doppler light up with multiple flash flood events, dumping about 2 months' worth of rain in just a few hours. And then this week, I watched rivers surge 10 to 15 feet in northeast Iowa with yet another 8-inch-plus gully washer. Now it's Florida and maybe the Gulf Coast on edge for a possible tropical storm Hermine this weekend. It could trigger another heavy multi-inch rainfall event across South Florida. But Hermine has been a little late to the party. It's slow to develop, still a tropical wave south of the Bahamas today. And the latest forecast models have shifted south a bit, but still favor a tropical storm developing this weekend with the potential to dump some multi-inch rains. So here's the question. Will Hermine eventually become a tropical storm or a hurricane that could end a longer hurricane drought in the Gulf of Mexico? It's Bob Henson. He's a hurricane expert who writes for the always excellent Weather Underground Wunder blog. He joins us via Skype today from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Paul. Very great to be here.
Hey, good to talk to you again, as always. Let's start with the past few days. This tropical wave has kind of run into a rough neighborhood for tropical development this week. I saw you wrote a good summary in the Wunder blog with Jeff Masters last night. What factors have prevented this system from becoming a named storm a little bit sooner?
Ironically, one of the biggest challenges it's had has been that it's a very large wave. And that sounds a little bit counterintuitive. You would think, oh, large physical size, therefore it's more powerful.
Yeah.
But when you have a large system that's not very well organized, you have little swirlies, to use a technical term.
That is very technical.
So you have these little spins of vorticity or circulation kind of rotating around this large gyre, mm-hmm. and it could take them a few days to figure out kind of which one is going to be the alpha dog of the pack.
Interesting.
And that didn't really happen until very, very recently with 99L.
Well, and I noticed I'm watching the infrared satellite loop here overnight and this morning. It looks like a really strong convective flare just near Eleuther Island, which is in the southern Bahamas, a little bit northeast of Cuba. Is that the beginning of what could be Hermine?
I think it may be. You know, I woke up this morning pretty early, about 5 a.m. mountain time, and when my first look at things told me, oh, this is toast, you know, not much is going to happen. And then, as you just pointed out, in the last few hours, we have a really impressive blow up of thunderstorms over Eleuther Island. And that's closer to the center than anything has been so far with this system. And you may also notice the storms that had prevailed further south in the northern Caribbean have subsided. So mm-hmm. That was probably pulling some energy away from any attempt to consolidate up more toward the actual center of the wave. And now we have thunderstorms really focusing more over the center. So I think the next few hours are going to be really crucial. We could see some pretty major development, I would say. And certainly this leaves the door open for potential development next week as the system makes its way kind of through the Florida area and on into the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, and it also is working into an area with less wind shear aloft. Explain to our listeners why wind shear aloft is a bad thing for potential hurricane formation.
That's right. Now, your listeners probably know, given your location, that when it comes to severe thunderstorms, wind shear can be a really helpful thing in causing severe weather and tornadoes. And that's because thunderstorms need some sort of separation between the area where the winds are blowing upward and forming the rain and hail and whatnot, and where the rain and hail and whatnot are falling. So you want those kind of compartments of the storm to be distinct. When you have strong wind shear, that allows that to happen. It pushes the rain and hail away from where the updraft is happening. Mm-hmm. Now, with a hurricane, it's just the opposite. A hurricane is more like a classic heat engine where the air is rising in the center, you have thunderstorms ringing the center, and the air is being spewed out at the top, much like a thunderstorm, but in a way where you if you had very much wind shear, the rain would be falling into the eye and it would kind of pinch off the center of the heat engine. So with hurricanes, the less wind shear, the better. And that has indeed been one of the main problems with 99L. It's had more wind shear than I think we expected for a couple of days. And that has helped displace the bottom of the wave, if you want to call it that, yep, from the top. Now it's going into an area with much less wind shear, and that's going to be the case for the next several days. So that's going to give it a real shot in the arm.
It's also working the track models, what we call the spaghetti models in hurricane forecasting, because they look like strands of spaghetti laid out on a map when you plot all these different model tracks. They've shifted a little bit south, and that does something that potentially could help this system. It looks like it may take it through the Florida Straits. So just north of Cuba, just south of the Florida Keys, that could be a favorable environment for development, right?
Indeed. I was thinking a day or two ago that the core of this system would probably hug the coast of, say, Dominican Republic, mm-hmm, and Cuba. And instead, it looks like it's going to be several hundred miles north of there, really threading the needle kind of parallel to Cuba and over the Straits, maybe, you know, close to some of the Keys. And that is worrisome even in the short term because the system doesn't have a lot of time to develop, but that area is prone to rapid development.
Yeah.
I think that's easier to happen with a smaller circulation with a large one. So
sure,
that will tend to put the brakes on it a little bit. But, you know, we could, I think, easily have a tropical storm, maybe even a minimal hurricane by the time it gets toward the outer part of the Keys. And as I think you know, it takes a couple of days to prepare the Keys and get people out of there if it was a major hurricane.
Right.
I don't think we're looking at that, but they're still going to have quite some weather there, I suspect, by Sunday, when it looks like it'll be in that vicinity.
And it's running into some warm water, so that may help it too. The models, the tracks, I know we focus a lot on the European model. We focus on NOAA's GFS model. There are many models that track these hurricanes. But the Euro seems like it might be doing a better job once again with a tropical system than the GFS. I guess the question is sort of, Houston, do we have a problem with the GFS when it comes to forecasting tropical storm tracks?
You know, I have to say the GFS has done pretty well in some respects in that it was a little less aggressive with kicking the system off already.
That's true.
So whereas some of the runs of the Euro and some of the other models had it as a tropical storm already. So I give the GFS kudos for that. In terms of what's going to happen now, I am leaning a little more toward the European solution, which is for the last few days been to take the system basically into the Gulf of Mexico. And some other models are also in that direction, including the UK Met model, which is one of the better models, again, for tropical cyclone genesis. So I think it's pretty safe bet that it's going to go into the Gulf. There's still a lot of uncertainty about where in the Gulf it's going to go, although the models are pretty insistent that it's going to head generally northward, or at least with the north component. So it's going to be hard to avoid a U.S. landfall with this one.
Yeah, and it looks
which
like,
raises the... Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to jump in. It looks like it could take it up the west coast of Florida conceivably. So, and it, you know, as a tropical storm, which doesn't sound like that bad of a deal, but heavy rain is still an issue. And let's remember that Louisiana system didn't even have a name. So we really don't want to focus on that.
Yeah.
Bob, I want to bring in somebody who's in the potential path of this storm. Philip Stoddard is the mayor of South Miami, Florida. Hey, Philip, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. And I'm going to take issue right away with the use of the word better.
Yeah.
When you say it's better for storm, you're thinking of this as a, as from the perspective of a storm enthusiast. And I'll tell you, when we say better, we love wind shear because it tears the storms apart. That's better from our perspective.
Of course. And you know what, Philip, I'm really not doing it as a storm enthusiast as much as an analyst. So I hear you. I know there's people in the path of these things. So you know,
I was just meeting with my research lab. I'm also a professor at FIU, and we have a big operation up on the roof of the building, which we have to take down when we've got a hurricane. We actually had Katrina come right over the top of the building, and we were caught. We were caught by surprise. It was projected to be a tropical storm that would pass north of us, and right before it came ashore, it spun up into a Cat 1, took a sharp left turn, went right over the top of the building. We got amazing records of it, but it also took all of our equipment and strewed it all over the campus. So,
yep, and that's a good point that these things, intensity is one of the areas that is still the least certainty in terms of hurricane forecasting. Now, Philip, I know you've been following the forecast. You're probably in touch with the National Hurricane Center that's in your backyard. Are you in prep mode already in terms of this storm and rainfall as we head into the weekend?
Yeah, we are. In fact, the Hurricane Center is located on my campus here, just on the other side of campus. So, you know, when we get a hurricane watch or warning or even a projection like we've seen, there's some things you have to start doing in advance. So in Miami, for instance, we haven't had a serious storm since Katrina and Wilma back in 2005. Mm-hmm. So being 11 years, you know, our yards have gotten overgrown a bit with trees. You know, we've let, things accumulate. This is the time when you take a good hard look at it. So I was out yesterday strapping down the kayaks again, taking things and putting them in different places, just because I know if the storm spins up, I don't have time to do that work then. So we already have our hurricane plans in place at the university. The cars are gassed up except for our electric car, which doesn't need gas.
How about for the city? What kind of plans are in place for the city?
Well, all of the managers, I mean, this is a standard drill. We've got everything ready, essentially. You know, at the beginning of the hurricane season, all of the municipal and county government agencies get their marching orders for what they have to do. They go back, make sure they've got the supplies in place. They make sure they've got their staffing prepared. It's a drill. We all know how to do it by now.
But as you follow, here's my question. As you follow the forecast, how do you prepare or do you prepare differently for different kinds of storms? I mean, I'm talking about a potential major hurricane with a lot of wind versus potentially this one, a tropical storm, maybe not as much wind, but possibility for some heavy rainfall totals. Is that a different preparation process for the city of South Miami?
Well, initially it's the same because, you know, when you're several days back, you get, say, you know, 1 week out, you say, okay, what do we have to do if this thing spins up strong? And you start those preparations, and at any point you can kind of back off. So you know that there's points where you just have to make a call and say, we're going to go for it, because if you don't make that call, you won't have time if it does spin up. So there's many times when you can back off, but you have to start preparing about a week out to make sure you're ready if it doesn't back off.
Bob, hurricane forecasts, so we've come a long way with hurricane track accuracy. Those intensity changes, precise rainfall forecasts, still very difficult to nail down. Why is that, and how do we refine these forecasts to help people like Philip and residents of cities like South Miami?
That's an excellent question. You know, hurricane tracks are steered literally by the steering currents. You have a hurricane, you can think of it as an object in the larger flow, which extends up a few miles through the atmosphere. And so the hurricane or tropical storm is simply being moved along by those currents. And sometimes different layers of the atmosphere will have a bigger influence than other layers. But generally, if you can map the flow in the larger environment around the hurricane, then you can do a pretty good job of predicting the track. And our models are getting better and better at that. Intensity is still the big challenge. It remains a challenge. We are making a lot of progress. I would say the HWRF model, the Hurricane Weather Research and Forecasting Model, that has become a real all-star in the last couple of years, once the system gets going.
You're in the Weather Lab with Paul Huttner here at NPR News. I've got Weather Underground's Bob Henson via Skype from D.C. and Philip Stoddard. He's the mayor of South Miami, Florida. Mayor Stoddard, I should point out to our science-loving audience here on Minnesota Public Radio that You're actually trained as a scientist, and we do a weekly show here called Climate Cast. I would be remiss if I didn't talk about climate change with the mayor of South Miami. So I know you've been very candid about your view on climate change, how it's affecting South Florida. Of course, this is one storm that we're talking about today, but it's really superimposed over the bigger backdrop of climate change in South Florida, right?
Absolutely. And so, you know, this being yet again the hottest year on record, we watch the temperature, you know, sea surface temperatures, which, you know, have been going up, you know, across the years. We know that most of the global warming has been taken up by the oceans, and in Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean, I mean, this is food for hurricanes. Mm-hmm. So what we recognize is that when you've got these warm waters, a hurricane can spin up a lot faster than it could with cooler sea surface temperatures.
Sure, and we hear a lot about lately, especially I think the political dynamics of climate change in Florida. Is the state government responsive to your needs in a low-lying area like South Miami?
The governor actually cut our budget, you know, allocations by the legislature that we had asked for climate adaptation, and he's done this a couple years in a row.
Yeah.
So what does that say?
It probably says it all. Real estate values. I read a piece where you talked about that recently. How does that play out going forward when thousands of homes may, not figuratively, but literally be underwater in the next 50 to 100 years?
Well, you know, at some point, you know, real estate values go to zero as the land becomes water. There is no real estate. And so then the big game is trying to figure out, you know, when the music stops.
Yeah.
And there's different ways this could happen. We know if the waters are just to come up slowly, you know, land prices would go down sort of steadily and predictably, but that's not how it works. What happens is ultimately we do get the big hurricane, another Andrew-type storm, and things get rocked suddenly.
Yeah.
And it could also happen with rain. I mean, we could get one of those storms like they had in Louisiana where a big system parks on top of you and dumps 2 feet of rain, and Florida's mighty flat. I mean, our water has nowhere to go. So I remember some years back I was a new professor working on an NSF grant late one night. It was raining cats and dogs, and I didn't want to leave my office into that kind of storm. So I waited till finally it was clear it wasn't going to stop. I waded out through waist-deep water, and I managed to drive partway home till my car finally flooded out. I pushed it a block or two to a safe place, and I waded home.
Wow.
You know, this can happen down here.
And that's, you know, Bob Hansen, that's interesting because climate change is sort of this background hum. Maybe some people think it's a slow process, which in a way it is, but it really doesn't hit home until it hits home. And then you superimpose that on the next higher sea level or the next strongest storm or the next heavier rainfall event. All of a sudden, climate change becomes sort of a climate shock, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I've been thinking a lot about the situation in Miami and Miami Beach, and I'm interested if Phil would like to comment on this, on the increase in nuisance flooding. And even a storm that's relatively weak, like 99L might well be, or if it becomes Tropical Storm Hermine, conceivably could produce a fair amount of flooding, especially in Miami Beach. Am I right, Philip?
Well, you know, the nuisance flooding that's so characteristic of our coastal areas really is floods on the king tide, where the where the currents come in. So when we see, you know, if we got a foot of rain, which happens from time to time, mm-hmm. It's really more of an issue not on the coastal areas, which are better sloped and well drained, but it's more of an issue for us inland, closer to the Everglades side. You have to recognize that Miami is in between Biscayne Bay and the Atlantic on the east and the Everglades on the west. And so big rains are really more of an issue on the west side of town, where the water, essentially the town used to be Everglades and it becomes Everglades again on a temporary basis. The canals and the streets and the water become one, and you can't tell even where the roads are.
You know, it's a fascinating view from, I think, those of us who sit in the middle of the country to get this perspective, Mayor Stoddard. It's very valuable stuff, and we certainly appreciate your input this morning. Thanks for joining us.
No, you're very welcome. Thanks.
Bob Hansen from Weather Underground, great discussion today. Thanks so much.
Thank you. My pleasure. Appreciate it, Paul.
And guess what, folks? We have a special treat for you today. You remember NPR meteorologist Craig Edwards? Yeah, he checked out of Minnesota after a long and successful weather career, retired to Florida last fall. Now he lives in tropical Fort Myers. So I thought this would be a great opportunity to hear from Craig again, get his perspective on life in hurricane country. Craig Edwards, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Paul. Yeah, I moved down here and bought some cheap swampland. As you know, a lot of Florida is swamp, and as I observed since I've been down here in October, that what they do is they take stuff from the swamp and build it up into a subdivision, and there's still more swamp. So I don't know what the effects are going to be if we get heavy rain in South Florida, but I'm sure that there's been a lot of population expanded. And a lot of territory has been expanded with urban development, and that could impact what city planners have not known in 10 years since the last tropical storm.
Yeah, and we saw that certainly in Louisiana with the off-the-charts rainfall totals. You know, I just have to say it's so great to hear your voice on NPR again. What's it like down there living in hurricane country? Does it change your perspective a little on as storms roll in or develop in the Atlantic?
Well, I think, Paul, there's still a number of people, my observations, that don't get excited about this stuff until somebody is painting a more clear picture of what's going to happen with the storm. And I think what your previous guest had talked about is the conditions become more favorable for this thing to probably intensify, and it could grow right overhead. So then the track of this system would put my territory, the west side or the Gulf side, in a more favorable area for perhaps heavy rain. And Lake Okeechobee cannot handle the 10-inch rainfall, I think, at this stage, after we've had the 14 inches of rain in the dry season of January, which was a problem with Lake Okeechobee.
What's the buzz on the street in Fort Myers about this storm? Any talk, or are people just not really paying attention yet?
Well, I think the people that have to respond, like, for example, I have a neighbor that works at the airport, and they told all the employees working there that this is the process the airport will have in case of a shutdown or temporary rerouting of air traffic. And the same thing is true with the Florida Power and Light. They've already issued emails to residents say that we're aware of what the situation is, and we're going to make sure we can do the best we can to have power maintained for portions of southwest Florida. So that goes on, and in the meantime, of course, the hardware stores have pushed all the emergency generators to the front of the store so you can load one in your car if you have to on that Saturday morning.
It reminds me of snow season here in Minnesota when you see the salt pallets come out and the snow blowers. Listen, here's the big question I think our listeners want to know. So do you miss Minnesota yet?
Oh, yeah. I miss, matter of fact, I was up there in June, and it was delightful with dew points in the upper 50s, low 60s. And the dew points down here, Paul, they start out in the low to middle 70s, and then perhaps by late afternoon they drop down to 72.
Oh.
So when I hear about the dew point whining in Minnesota, I go, oh, my goodness, it's 72 to 75 every day down here.
Yeah. Well, listen, I want to thank you for all you've done for me, Craig, and for Minnesota Public Radio. Please give my best to Sue and call us back and rub it in a little bit in January, won't you?
I'll do that. You have a good weekend, Paul.
You too. Thanks, Craig.
My name is Philip Rutter. I live in Canton, Minnesota, which is down in Fillmore County, not too far from Iowa. And this is what I saw Tuesday night. I was driving home from Rochester, Minnesota, and pretty much the entire way, we were driving through frog strangler rains, the windshield wipers on high, and the traffic moving at about 30 miles an hour. And I was desperately afraid that it was going to actually hit our farm dead on, so I hurried home. It's messing up our business. We normally ship plants out of Decorah, and we're not going to be able to for who knows how long. We're wondering if this weather stuff is ever going to let up for us here, because, in fact, last Friday, we got hit dead center by a bow echo storm. An awful lot of broken trees all over the county. And now we're wet. The ground is saturated. The water was immediately all running off anywhere it could find a place to run. So we are primed for the same kind of floods they've already got. down in Decorah.
Philip, you are so right. It has been a long and stormy summer from Ely and the Boundary Waters to Grand Rapids, Hill City, Brainerd Lakes, Duluth, and the North Shore. A 10-inch rain in Hinckley, Sump Pump Symphony here in the Twin Cities, and heavy storms in southern Minnesota where you live. Now, I checked with Todd Krause from the Twin Cities National Weather Service office. He tells me they have issued 229 severe thunderstorm and tornado warnings through July 31st compared to just 142 last summer. So yes, weather fans, we've definitely reached our severe weather quota this summer. In the Updraft blog this week, I wrote about how communicating weather is just as important as the forecast. The no-name storm that put 40,000 homes underwater in Louisiana caught many off guard. National media was criticized for that, for not hitting the storm harder. You know, in weather communication, it's usually a fine line between crying wolf and getting the public's attention. With so many competing weather voices on the air and Twitter, it's hard to know who to listen to. So in the free market of weather communication, it's getting even more important to know who to trust and who to follow. Forecast accuracy, that's the name of the game. And the words that we choose to communicate that forecast are important, maybe more important than ever. That's it from the Weather Lab this week. Thank you for listening. Happy Friday, everybody.